Charles, let's review again the two downsides possibilities of nanotechnology, and then you can elaborate on that second one again.
Sure. Well, these are the two that I focus on the most. Now, other folks have other ideas. I'm just going to say these are the ones I'm most scared about because I've actually seen evidence that these things could exist. Then the first one was what I refer to as selective disassembly, and that would be essentially using a sort of a nanite approach to dissolving or in some way chemically altering the physical properties of certain key materials that you would find in a vehicle, like a tank or a truck or possibly a plane. And the theory there is that you could burst a cloud through an aerosol dispersant, this kind of active element that would organically nibble away and you know, cause harm to the system in question. But the larger question says, well, once you hatch this stuff, would it keep on nibbling away and causing harm in areas that you didn't expect? Or, you know, could it mutate to something different? And that's where I would be very, very concerned. And then in parallel with that, the same sort of nanobiology realm of development also points to something called proteomic targeting. And you were mentioning earlier medical applications. And so I want to start by saying proteomic targeting could be the ultimate sort of Pandora's box in terms of things like cancer, maybe AIDS, a whole variety of diseases. And the reason it's so interesting is because it's a way of very precisely selecting a specific cell type and only that cell type to neutralize it or to turn it off or in some way change its behavior so it doesn't cause harm to the rest of the body. In other words, in today's world, in most cases, you ingest some kind of a compound or a drug, and that drug will hopefully go after the sort of pathology in question. But the problem is that usually most of these drugs have some kind of side effect with them or several side effects, and they have to take other drugs to neutralize the effect of the first drug and so on.
Right.
It would be much better, and of course many physicians feel the same way, if they could say, I just want to go after this one particular cell, this tumor, for instance, and only go there and nowhere else and don't affect anything else. And then once you get to that tumor, go inside that tumor and then through something called P43 protein, which is one of the proteins currently used for this purpose, turn the cell off. It would say stop, and the tumor gets neutralized, and away you go. However, the same exact procedure could also be used for something like, and this sounds horrible, so forgive me, but you could use this to selectively pick out target people because of a genetic marker. And
mm-hmm.
this could be something like, say, a racial marker or some other specific marker.
Or religious.
Well, there's no genetic marker I know of that specifies a religion. But there are genetic markers that can identify just about every physical trait that we can observe. And there's now, of course, even neurophysiology folks who are looking at mental traits, which can also be identified through genetic
markers. Of course,
markers.
But what I meant by religious is I meant that if there was an area in this country that was predominantly a certain kind of belief, you could go after that.
You could go after a proclivity for belief systems. I think you might be able to get that far. But here's where I'm trying to go. The fact that these ideas can even be discussed and considered as potential future options in some kind of bizarre military situation is very scary because, again, the problem is that once you begin to unravel the mechanism of something as potentially dangerous as a quasi-viral component, as an example, the point is that these things can mutate, and they will. And, I mean, I think that there's, in terms of unexpected consequences, this is by far the area where it gets to be most unknown, because even if you design some kind of synthetically contrived sort of quasi-organic thing that can do this, the end result is it'll most certainly mutate into some other form, and then all of a sudden you've released some kind of biopathogen that may end up killing the entire human species.
A monster that you can't stop.
A monster that you can't stop. And, you know, back when I was working in Star Wars and I was at Los Alamos, and I'll just make this as a kind of reference point, this is a number of years ago, but back then, things were kind of simple. We sort of knew what the target goal was. Our primary interest was Soviet Russia, and we were concerned about incoming warheads and, you know, missiles and planes and that kind of thing. So we were developing ways that we thought would be the best way to neutralize those systems from delivering, you know, some kind of nuclear nightmare. But it was a very narrowly defined target, and more importantly, Soviet Russia, for all their political differences, were basically people like us. I mean, they had the same general vision of life and wanting to care for their families, and you know, there was a logic that you could kind of follow, and that's how this what was called MAD, or mutually assured destruction, became a policy that in fact worked, because it became to a certain point where it was obvious that nobody was going to win, that no matter how far you push the technology curve, there was always going to be something worse around the corner, and so why bother? And I think that's partly how Reagan convinced Gorbachev to essentially stop what he was doing. However, in our current world, we have a new kind of much more diffuse sort of threat, if I can put it that way, and you have an ideology, a religious ideology, since you brought that up, where the concept of life is not even the same as we see it. And people are willing to do things that are horrendously destructive, and they don't even care if it kills huge amounts of people or even themselves. In fact, people gleefully walk into a situation where they specifically kill themselves as a part of their larger agenda. And so how do you apply a mutually assured destruction kind of protocol to an ideologically driven entity that has no concerns about those things in the first place? This is a very different kind of world. So if you mix that kind of ideology together with these kinds of sort of nanobiological weapon systems potentially in the future, that's where things could get very ridiculous indeed.
I mean, they can, and these things are machines, aren't they, even though they may be part biological?
Yeah, this is where it gets very fuzzy. It's a sort of a virus is like a self-replicating machine in a way, and that's kind of a clumsy description. But basically what a virus does, just a real simple description, is that it will have a specific proteomic signature that can mate to a specific kind of cell. And when it finds that cell, it enzymically sort of oozes its way through the cell membrane and through the cytoplasm, and eventually gets to what's called the ribosome. And the ribosome is a particular kind of organelle component that's specifically designed to spew out very quickly and in very large volume replications of molecules that the cell would normally want to use for its physiological interest. And this is usually done through something called messenger proteins. However, what the virus does is it sort of cancels out the messenger protein and says, aha, make more of me instead. So it utilizes the cell's own ribosome to replicate huge numbers of the viruses and spit them out. And that's why viruses can be so deadly and so quick in what they do. So in a way, if somebody were to create a quasi-viral component-like system, that is a kind of a quasi-life form that has the potential to utilize another cell's ability to replicate it, then yes, that could become a mutatable object, and you would have unexpected consequences as a result.